Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we are in LA Talk Radio. This is, of course, the Writer's Block because it is Thursday evening. I am Jim Christina, your host, in the studio right now with Mr. Russ Avison down there, beautiful, sunny Southern California and Fillmore, California. Hi, Rossi.
Hey, Jimmy. And it is sunny and nice today. We've been really cold, but it's been nice yesterday and today.
You know what? It was like 66 today here.
Oh, I think you beat us.
Oh, and I have great news. I have great news.
I like the news. Yeah, I mean great news.
Last year, I bought a screen door for a sliding glass door because when we bought the house, it didn't have one. Well, I got it put together, but of course, I went to the hospital before I could get it installed.
Yes.
So we had two or three handymen come out here and try to get it. They said, no, it's too short. It's too short. It's too short. So today, I grabbed this measuring tape and I went out there and measured the door opening. It was 80 inches.
Yes.
I measured the screen door was 81 inches. Now, how can that be too short?
Maybe they meant the opening was too short.
Well, no, what they meant was that they, when they put the door in, they allowed it to sink down onto the bottom track and they didn't adjust the bottom to put the rollers on the trail. So I put the rollers on there, adjusted it up, and my God, we have a screen door now.
No, just hopefully Bella doesn't crash through it.
Well, yeah. Well, you know your dog. I So, how's things going? Is things loosening up down there in California?
It's starting to a little bit. It's still, you know, our business is dependent upon people traveling.
Of course.
And they're just not doing that much of it yet. But I see it changing. There's an upward trend. And when you talk to people, there's a different atmosphere. People seem to be more upbeat, like they feel that things are changing, and that's a good thing.
Well, God, I hope so. I'm so tired of the mask thing, and we actually get our next our last shots a week from tomorrow.
Oh, I'm done. I've been 2 weeks.
Yeah, I know you are.
Yeah,
I'm
ready to dance with the devil.
We get ours a week from tomorrow, and 2 weeks. After that, we can go visit the grandkids and
that's awesome.
Which are 10 doors down.
Oh, and Ronan just said he got his first one today.
Oh, did he? Oh my God! Well, Ronan, wow! Look at you.
Yeah, we just wait for the second one because that's the one that usually drops everybody.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Tonight's guest is I'm just going to go through her bio because, you know, we ask all our writers to present their own biographies, and they do, and we just hope they don't lie because their friends always call and tell us. Lily doesn't have hayseed clinging to her clothes, but growing up in a Canadian farm gave her a unique foundation as a writer. She sprouted under cumulus clouds that bloomed everywhere in Alberta's big sky. Oh, my God. Talk about
she
a writer.
She wrote that, I can tell.
I know that, yeah. They were her first creative writing instructors, scudding across the heavenly blue, constantly changing shape, 1 minute an elephant, bruised and brooding, the next morphing into a rabbit or a Kessel. These billowing masses gave her unique view of life on Earth. Her reviews, interviews, and short fiction poetry traveled pieces, essays, and memoirs have appeared in over 165 American and Canadian venues. Her novel, Fling, was published in 2015. Curva Peligrosa was launched in 2017. Free Fall, a Divine Comedy, which is what we'll be discussing tonight, was released on 1/1/19. Her poetry collection, All This, was published in 2011, and her poetry chapbook, No More Kings, came out in March 2020. She has taught rhetoric for over 30 years at the University of San Francisco. She currently teaches creative writing at University of San Francisco's Fromm Institute of Lifelong Learning. She blogs, she's a reader, she's a writer, and please welcome to the Writer's Block, Lila Iona McKenzie. Welcome to the show, Lila, or Lila, or Lily.
Lily, kind Lily.
Lily, yeah.
You get an A for that.
Oh, well, I got through the whole thing.
You did.
Except for the name. What
except
are you
for
do?
The name. That's okay, Lily.
And I know about the book, who cares, right?
So I didn't catch that, Russ.
As long as people buy the book, who cares what they call you?
Exactly.
Yes, I guess. Yes.
Free Fall of Divine Comedy is a different book than we're used to reading. And why is that?
Yeah.
Because it didn't have any pictures.
Well, we are used to pictures.
You're supposed to make your own pictures when you read pictures.
We did.
And we did on that book, I'll tell you.
We talked about this the other night. You have this genre as literary magical realism, and I said I didn't never hear of that genre. And you said, well, you've heard of magical realism. I said, well, yeah, we have had authors on the show with magical realism before. And you said, well, this just gives it it's a little bit higher in quality. So I said, oh, kind of like a sergeant being promoted to a lieutenant. Yeah, kind of like that. It is a different type of story in that it's old relationships, new relationships, old loves, new loves. And it takes a woman into a realm of which I don't think she's quite ready for, but she understands it's happening that way. Let's have you explain the book a little bit, if you would.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me tell you how I came to write it. When I was a much younger woman, I had three friends, and we all had grown up in Calgary, Canada, and we decided we were going to go to Toronto, move to Toronto. And we were in our late teens, and we were full of ourselves, and we called ourselves the Four Musketeers. And things happened in Toronto. We ended up not being Four Musketeers. We ended up having fights and throwing dishes at each other and separating. And I didn't hear from a couple of these women ever again. But this is 2021. It was probably around 2000, year 2000, when my husband and I went up to Canada. And while we were up there in Vancouver, I met up with one of these women, and she invited my husband and myself to, come to her place in Whistler, British Columbia. It's a beautiful ski area. And to my surprise, another one of those women who had been one of the Four Musketeers all those years ago, she was there too. And so when I came home, I'm thinking, what would happen if all four women got together again? And, what would their take be on each other? And what would their lives be like? And that's what got me started writing this novel. So as you've probably discovered, Tilly, the main character, is an installation artist. She's kind of wacky.
Right.
And she's approaching her 60th birthday, as they all are. And she hasn't quite made it fully as an artist. She's poor. She has to write for grants to support herself. She does menial work when she has to, takes in roommates and so on. And so she's still trying to make it as an artist. But she ends up having a phone conversation with one of these women from her past. And they decide during this call to have a reunion and to all meet in Whistler, B.C., at this cabin. And that starts them off then on this voyage into their past And during those 4 days, let's see, how many days were they in Whistler? Yes, I think it was just about 4 days. During that time.
4 days, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a while since I wrote the book and read it.
You wrote the book, Lily.
Keep me on my toes, you guys. So while they're in Whistler, they do take a hike up at the top of one of these mountains and have an interesting encounter with a grizzly bear. And they also, while they're there, Tilly discovers that one of the women, her name is Sybil, that she has a place in Venice. Not only does she have this cabin in Whistler, but she has a place in Venice. And so Tilly, who's always on the lookout for opportunities, she, says, why don't we all continue this reunion in Venice and celebrate our 60th birthdays there? And so they finally all end up agreeing to do that. But Tilly had other things in mind. As you probably know, Venice has this biennale, this art biennale, for years, and it's a guild, and those who do participate are pretty well known. So Tilly wanted to crash the biennale, and that was her main motive for getting them to go to Venice. So they have some very interesting experiences in Venice. A pigeon takes a liking to Tilly. She's sitting in St. Mark's Square, and this pigeon won't leave her alone. And tapping on her head, and she begins doing some little tricks with the pigeon. People laugh, and they drop money in front of them because of the tricks they're doing. And then the bird won't go. The bird follows her wherever she goes, and won't leave. And so Tilly gets it in her mind that this bird, this pigeon, is really her former lover Frank, who had just recently died and had been a photographer. She gets it in her mind that this is Frank that's returned in this bird, in this pigeon, and is chasing her all over the place and won't leave her alone. Anyway, so Tilly does begin to put together an installation piece in Venice sort of secretly, and it actually ends up being somewhat of a success, but most important is the things that these women discover about each other over the process of these two separate reunions. And then there are other people, other characters that come into their lives in Venice too that complicate things. It's essentially a story about old friends and who are struggling with aging and motherhood and men and art and death. And so death has a role in this novel as well.
How much of this is autobiographical?
Not really, no. The only autobiographical part is that I did have this relationship with these three other women years ago, and we never did have a reunion. So this is my imagination of how that might have gone if we'd had a reunion. So, I mean, the only autobiographical things might be, tiny little incidents. Authors, often draw on past experiences to describe certain scenes or whatever, but it's not autobiographical. I'm not an installation artist, though I wish I were. And when I wrote the novel originally, I had only spent 2 days in Venice. So much of it's from my imagination.
The Piazza San Marco is nothing but pigeons. Absolutely nothing but pigeons.
I've been
there's
back.
Bound to have one follow you somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I found that the interaction between these four women was interesting in that And we don't, I mean, us as being men don't understand the interaction with most women. We have no capacity to understand it. We're lucky really? To understand one, much less four, especially in a group. And, Sybil really rang true for me because I knew somebody like Sybil.
Did you?
I did. I went to high school, and then I ran into her three or four times since then. And then all of my high school reunions, I went to the 20th and the 30th and the 35th. I think it was the three I went to. Uh-huh. And she was always there. She was always actually on the reunion committee, so you kind of have to run into her. Uh-huh. But she was always the one that was dressed to the nines and, you know, I mean, not talking about her wealth as much as effusing her wealth out. It's rain from her pores. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
much like Sybil. I mean, she has a cabin, and her cabin is like a three-story mansion on the side of a mountain.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So, but I found your dialogue refreshing. I found it very real. And it bothered me a lot in that the bickering between the women, although it was like women fight, you know, well, they say one says another, and they don't ever mean to hurt, but they do.
And I
found that to be very, very authentic. So kudos. And I'm actually with that, I'm going to put us on a break for just a minute. Don't go away. We're going to have a real short break. This is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. And we will return very shortly, right after this quick word from LA Talk Radio.
Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, well, now is certainly your opportunity. Go to www.latalkradio.com. Find the link that says Be a Host and follow the instructions. You know, everybody's got something to say. And if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com. And listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, for The Writer's Block, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we are back. It is now 6:16, and we are on the air with writer Lily Iona McKenzie. And if you want to call and talk to Lily, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And again, get a pencil and write this down, 323-203-0815, and Russ is writing it down. Okay. I have a question regarding the construct of this particular story, because obviously it took you more than a week to write it.
Did you notice?
Yeah, I did. you know, being a writer, I noticed the flow of things, and whereas you don't jerky start and stop, you do bring us along in segments. And I like that. I like that about stories. I like to be brought along in a segment. One is over with. Now we're going to go to two. And when you wrote this novel, did you know that you were going to do that, or did that just come naturally as you wrote?
Well, you know, I don't have any idea where I'm going when I start a novel. I'm not the kind of writer who has, you know, a plan. And everything falls into place, you know, from that plan. I start out knowing nothing. And that's the fun for me of writing, is following wherever the characters take me and where the narrative takes me. So, structure, I played around with the structure, changed it around. At one point, I had it starting in Venice. And then going back, you know, as a flashback to Whistler and that part of it. So I didn't know at the beginning, Jim.
Well, I have to say that the opening of this book is interesting in that you have Tilly, she's waking up, and we go through her morning routine with her.
Right.
Which is, I mean, I'm thinking to myself as I'm reading this morning routine with Tilly, oh my God, that's pretty much what everybody does in the morning, I think.
but they don't do it the way she does it.
Yeah. And then we get a call from Mom. Okay.
Yeah.
I used to get those.
You got those?
I don't anymore. My mother passed years ago, but I remember those phone calls in the morning, and I remember her lamenting the fact that my father had died, and that she missed him, and she didn't really miss him. She missed him, but she didn't really, because he was always too soft on his kids, and he ruined her life. And whoa,
what was that?
That was something my electronic. That was my bat phone.
Oh, it's like what was that? Our man Flint.
Yeah, there you go.
but she always would call, and then she would start in the lamentation of that. But she really never loved my father. He ruined her life. She wanted to be a singer, and he dragged her away from it, and blah blah blah. So
you've had a mother too.
Well, yeah. Excuse me. Oh yeah, I did have a mother, and actually, yeah, that's what she was. Biologically, she was my mother. Emotionally, not so much.
Not so much. Yeah. Well, Tilly had the same problem.
Right. Yeah. It's like her comment about, you know, why are you missing Fred so much? You never really liked him all that much.
Yeah.
Well, but he was a warm body to sleep with. Now all I have is my cat. My cat died. You know.
This hits a little too close to home.
Yeah, I hear that. But when you started writing this book, I mean, did you know where it was going to end up? Did you honestly?
No idea.
You're a pantser, is what you're telling me. You write by.
I'm telling you. Yes, that's what I'm telling.
Yeah, you know what? Most of the really good writers that we've had on this show have been pantsers. And that gives them the freedom to change things as it comes along. They're not stuck into a mold of an outline or a story segment. They know kind of the end, beginning, they know the end. How the character gets from one side to the other is totally unknown at that point.
Yeah, and I don't know the end. I never know the end.
You know the beginning, so there you go. And you weren't even trying to be sure of that.
I mean, it'd be boring if I knew the end. Why would I want to write it if I already knew the end?
That is true.
Good point. But let me ask you, when you got to the end, did it change several times, or did you get to the end and said, this is it, this is what I want?
You know, I have a kind of affinity for endings for some reason. They seem to happen naturally for me. And I, you know, it doesn't mean that I don't rework them or, you know, rethink them. But when I get there, I know, okay, this is it. So, yeah.
You know, something that just stuck with me with this book is that you remember the movie or the TV series, I guess it was, and a movie, Sex and the City?
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think I ever saw it.
Interesting. Okay, well, that story was about four women that were friends living in New York, and they all had very varied backgrounds. But one of the things that really bothered me about that show was that the women seemed very shallow. It seemed like, you talked about in your book, one of your characters talks about not wanting her life to be defined by a man.
Right.
And I found that these characters in Sex and the City were all about the men. That was what set them. I mean, that's what they were about. There was a character that was very similar to Sybil that had a long train line of men that she had been with. That was her thing all the time. There was one that was she wasn't an artist, but she was a writer, and she smoked like a fiend quite a bit, which I know in the books it was Sybil, but I was thinking more like Tilly. But I guess the thing that bothered me is when I watched the TV show, I was really troubled that women were that shallow. And I saw some of that in the women that you developed in this story.
And you saw that they were shallow?
Yeah, I don't mean shallow as a character development, but just the women themselves as a personality, they seem to be somewhat shallow. And I'm wondering, when women get together, is it really like that?
Well, women do get into conversations that get below the surface of just, you know, the sort of the polite things that people talk about around a dinner table. Mm-hmm. Although some dinner table conversations can go very deep too. But no, women do talk about a lot of the things that I write about in the book. I mean, what are the things that puzzled you that they talked about, or that maybe bothered you?
Well, the one that smoked all the time, Sybil, and then they were talking to, haven't you ever heard of secondhand smoke and why are you doing this? It's, you know, I don't know about that stuff.
No, Sybil, but Sybil was an undeveloped person. I mean, as a character, she didn't have depth, and actually, the one who probably Daddy, that character, she's sort of in between. She's a reader, and she's, you know, she's more knowledgeable about cultural things and so on. And the other one, Moll, she's more of a mother type and homebody, nature woman. So she's not, you know, culture isn't her thing. And, you know, if you read it, you know that she doesn't care for museums and that kind of arty stuff. So
when they went to Venice, that was the thing she didn't
want to do.
No, I was just saying that when they decided to go on their trip, she was the one who said, I don't want to go to museums. I don't want to do that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So it really, you know, it really is showing kind of a cross section of these particular female characters, and one of them's a lesbian. Mm-hmm. Daddy, ironically, is a lesbian.
Right.
Yeah.
But I found a lot of their conversations went to sex. And especially when they were older, I didn't expect that. I mean, I think that, you know, well, at least what you mean. I mean, I'm glad. I'm really happy to have this conversation. You know, in my 20s and 30s and 40s, I mean, that was really a big part of life. And I still very much enjoy it. But I've also expanded my horizons and maybe deepen my appreciation of my life, which does not revolve around sex, and it seemed to much more with these women.
Well, I think it makes sex a lot more special when your life is not revolving around it.
Well, no, I don't think their lives are revolving around sex, but sex happened to be. I mean, they all weren't. I mean, there was the instance with the two gypsies. At least got Sybil going, and of course there's Tilly's relationship with the half black, half Italian priest that she meets up with, and they fall for each other, and they have, of course. I mean, she's only 60. I mean, my God. Yeah, women are sexual creatures. I mean, and if you read the parts with Tilly and Bud, the priest, I mean, he had a little trouble, getting it up, and that's pretty normal, or it's normal for some people anyway. So it wasn't as if they were just, you know, that it was just sex, but it was part of the relationship, which is, I think it's part of every relationship, depending on how you define sex at certain times in your life.
Absolutely. Oh, hey, Lily, do me a favor. Back off from your phone a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You're kind of crackling in and out, and I think it's because you're too close to your phone.
Okay.
Oh, that was really nice. Thank you.
That worked.
Okay.
Now, being guys, you know, when a bunch of guys get four guys in a room in their 60s, the last thing they're going to talk about is sex.
That's really true.
Yeah. That's one thing that got, even in your 30s and 40s, guys don't sit around and talk about sex. It's just one thing we don't do. That's because I think we all assume we do it. We just don't talk about it.
Women, I think women think we talk about it all the time.
I think maybe.
You know, it's interesting. Go ahead.
I think that, I mean, sex is an intimate thing. And I think women are more comfortable, most women, yes, are more comfortable talking about, in quote, such intimate things.
Absolutely. I believe
that's
that.
True. 100%. That might be, yeah.
100%.
So, I mean, what else? I mean, they don't talk about sports usually. I mean, I talk to my son, I don't talk about sex. I talk about
I'm
sports.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, yeah. That would make your son very uncomfortable.
Make me very uncomfortable. Never mind my son.
No, guys, you get that. We talk about cars and motorcycles and what we're doing and what we do for work. Seems to be work is a big subject when guys get together.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. But sex is not in there. It's not anywhere in the equation. Look, we're going to take another real quick break, and then we're going to be right back. And we're going to take this real quick break with All Dogs Rule, and we'll be back in 35 seconds.
I'm going to read really slow then. Okay. You know, summer is approaching fast and the future for travel is looking pretty promising. And as you make your travel plans, you may be faced with the possibility that your favorite four-legged friend is not welcome at your destination. Well, why not let your dog stay at All Dogs Rule? Are you afraid he will have too much fun? Well, you're right. All Dogs Rule is a cage-free camp environment where your dog gets to run and play with other dogs among orange trees in the country setting of Fillmore. And round-trip transportation is available. When your dog returns home, that smile on his face will leave you asking, whose vacation really was better? Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. That's All Dogs Rule.
And we're back, and you, of course, can hear All Dogs Rule barking in the background because Russ is sitting in his office.
I am sitting in. I'm in my office surrounded by dogs.
Yes.
I mean, outside of the office. There's probably, I would say within 100 feet of me, there's probably 25 dogs.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Oh, yeah. His facility is absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, if you ever lived in Southern California and you wanted to take a vacation, that's where you want to take your dog.
Well, I wish I had a dog.
You can borrow mine.
Thanks.
I have a gorgeous golden retriever that is my best buddy.
How sweet. They're wonderful dogs.
And Russ is not only owns All Dogs Rule, but Russ also owns Canine Logic. Yeah. He's a trainer. And my dog went through... actually, every one of his programs, every single one. And she came out on the other side, a pretty damn smart dog.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Glad you didn't follow pursuit with that, you know.
I know, but I do work with her all the time on stuff that she learned while she was with you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's a golden retriever, so they're this ho-de-do dog. And, you know, when you're not being strict with her, she's all over the place. So, but anyway, I digress. So we talked about your book. Now let's talk a little bit about what got you into writing. I mean, you've obviously been writing for a couple of years. I've said that facetiously. What got you into first picking up the typewriter or the pen and
picking up the typewriter?
Whichever.
Well, I think it probably was a pen. I was 13. And I started keeping a secret diary. And the secret of the diary was that I created a kind of coded language for it because I was afraid someone could, you know, would look at it and be able to see what I'd written. I don't know what I wrote about then, but I'm sure it would have been things about what I was feeling, things maybe, you know, from my personal life with a family and so on. But that was my first attempt at looking inward and at trying to put on the page what I was, you know, thinking and feeling. And, of course, I don't know what happened to that secret diary. It's, it's disappeared from the earth, I hope. Then when I, you know, I was a high school dropout, so I, when I moved to the States, I was sponsored in the States, into the States by Bechtel Corporation. I had worked for them in Canada when they were building the Alberta to California gas pipeline, and they liked my work. And so they, I worked for them at their main office in San Francisco for about a year or so. And anyway, but, you know, I worked as a cocktail waitress at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco for much longer than I can imagine having done for 5 years. Really hard work. And but I had, you know, I was supporting myself and my son, and I had it was the only kind of work I could do that allowed me to do that. Eventually, I went through a deep depression in my mid to late 20s, and it was what rescued me. The depression got me into therapy, and I realized that I wanted more from my life than what I had at that moment. And so that's when I started. I'd always been a reader. I'd always read a lot. But that's when I realized that I might be able to go to college. And I, since I didn't have a high school diploma, I had to take the GED, that general education equivalency.
Right.
And I did well on it. And then I started college. I took tennis classes. Wasn't exactly writing, but I was so scared. I was terrified of going to college, but that opened the door for me. And so then I started taking, you know, other classes, and eventually I earned my AA, and then I went on to San Francisco State, and I was going to be a sociologist. That was my idea, or a social science major. That was my major. But then about halfway through my program there, I realized that my heart was in the humanities, and I switched my major. And then I also realized, excuse me, that I wanted to be a writer. And I began taking creative writing classes at that time. And it, you know, it just has rolled on since then.
You know, I absolutely loved creative writing. I'm much like you. My first PE course when I was in college was badminton. I mean,
badminton.
You know, I didn't want track. I didn't want anything to do with running anymore. I just said, you know, I got to take PE, so badminton. That was either, it was either that, golf, or bowling.
Bowling. I'm glad you left
that. That was my choices. So, and I wasn't a good enough golfer, and I can't bowl for crap. So, badminton it was.
Really?
Yeah, true story.
I didn't know that about. How, were you any good?
Yeah, actually, I got pretty good at badminton.
I would never guess that in a million years.
I wouldn't either, but it's a true story. So what can I say?
Well, so you know, what was your, I want to ask Lily, because you said you worked at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco for 5 years.
I did.
And I worked in the restaurant business for a number of years. And you're right. It is one of the most underappreciated, hardest jobs you can get.
Yes. Yes.
But yes. It really helps you understand people, doesn't it?
Well, I certainly saw a lot of them, and it helped my people watching skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the problem with the difficulty is that we weren't allowed to, we had to stand in our stations with our heavy trays. We couldn't sit down any place in, you know, inside the lounge, the cocktail lounge. And these were 8-hour shifts, and you'd get, you know, halfway you'd get a break, but it was, and you had to wear high heels. So this was really bloody hard work.
And the management doesn't appreciate anything that you do.
Well, the management it just has their hands all out, and both for money and for, you know, trying to fill up the waitresses. So you had to deal with that too.
I remember that. Yeah. I did a stint at Denny's between senior high school and my freshman year in college. I was a graveyard cook at a Denny's. Holy crap, what a job was that. It used to be really, really dead until like 1:45 when the bar crowd came in. And then you had a full restaurant full of drunks.
Oh, my.
Oh, my God. And, you know, nothing you did was right. Nothing you did was right. So, but my next door neighbor, Zell, it was Zell. And then there was a guy who lived in the house in front of us that we had rented out to him. His name was Boats. He used to come in at night and get really hammered. He was in the Bataan Death March. And his wife used to call around 2:30 and say, "Is Boats there?" "Yeah, he's here." "Okay, well, I'm going to send a car for him." But he'd pass out at the table in his food. But Zell used to come in and ask for kosher ham and eggs.
What does that mean?
There's no such thing. But he was such a bad Jew that he wanted ham, so he just called it kosher ham and eggs. So he just got his ham. But I do understand the restaurant thing. It's tough.
Yeah.
Even as a young person, it's hard. And I was 18.
Even as what?
Yeah, it's tough. It's a tough gig. No matter how old you are, restaurant work is hard.
It is hard.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Lily, do you find writing a much happier and less stressful job?
Well, I don't consider it a job. I have to write. It's what it's as important to me as eating. So if I don't write every day, ask my husband, I get irritable. Mm-hmm. So it's an essential part of who I am. It isn't a job. It's part of my life.
Right. Well, asking your husband would be a whole nother show.
That would be a show. My husband's a Joyce scholar, so you could ask him a lot of things about James Joyce, and he would keep you engaged for a long time.
Oh, James Joyce. I appreciate his writing a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, he's terrific.
Yes, he is. Okay, the question that we ask every single writer that is on this show, of course, the name of the show is The Writer's Block. And have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get out of it?
Well, you know, I write in different genres. So I'm a poet. I'm also write fiction. I write nonfiction. I journal. I keep a journal every day. I write in my journal. So I never have felt blocked because there was always something that I could work on. And so I can't answer your question any better than that. I'm sorry.
Okay. No worries. No, you know, I noticed that when I was reading your bio, and you have a poetry book. That's all. Is that the name?
Uh-huh,
of that?
Yeah.
I have one out called "That's All You Get."
Huh.
And it's everything that I wrote from 1967 when I was a senior in high school up through 1983, including poetry, musical lyrics, and everything, because I used to be a musician 150 years ago.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So, but I noticed that. I thought, wow, cool. That's kind of a cool title.
Yeah. No, mine's called All This.
Oh, that's right. All This. Okay.
Yeah.
But,
cool.
I don't think there's a whole lot of reach between being a writer of fiction into poetry, because it's just now you just got to make things rhyme.
It's a very different.
I know it's totally different, but the work ethic is the same.
If you're going to try and write a novel, you better be prepared for commitment. And if you can't commit yourself to years of work, you're not going to write a novel.
You heard this, Russ, right?
Yes, I'm listening. Jim keeps.
Are you trying to write a novel, Russ?
I keep hounding him.
Yeah, he does try, but
he's got at least two or three books in him, and he just won't sit down and do it.
It has to be a need, I think. I'm not sure it's something that you can dictate to yourself.
No, it's not. It's not. So, but we we still bug him about it. Hey, while I have your attention, let's take your last little break here. And don't go away, and we'll be right back to you. But this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. And we'll be right back after this real short word from Creative Edge.
Hi, Jim Christina here for Creative Edge Publicity. And you know there's a reason that authors flock to Creative Edge. Yes, it's true, and no one would believe it, but it is true. Creative Edge, the grassroots publicity firm that has stayed community-minded, is growing. And not only growing, but busting right out of their seams. With a client base of over 70 authors, 2 New York Times bestsellers, 6 USA Today bestsellers, and multiple international bestsellers and award winners, Creative Edge in 4 years has become one of the mainstays in the publicity book market, offering reader-focused opportunities in all levels of media, including podcasts, radio, TV, print, and much more. When it comes to publicity, Mickey Mickelson and Creative Edge are experts in the book industry. Look him up at www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future.
And we are back. And Lily, do you find that your characters sometimes take over your writing?
Well, the characters, how to answer that? I don't know that they take over, but they certainly, I try to follow them because I'm curious to see what's going to happen. And so I sort of approach it like a reader. I want to know what's going to happen next.
Sure.
I can't say they take over, but they certainly are very alive with me when I'm writing.
Uh-huh. Now you don't have any series. You have all standalones. Is that correct?
Well, I actually am going to have a follow-up to Free Fall with Tilly as a girl, and so it's really her from about 3 years old until 18, and it's entitled Confessions of a Canadian Girl in Training. So she's an interesting young character. All of the situations that she finds herself in and manages to escape them too. Uh-huh. But so that's supposed to come out this fall. The same publisher that published Free Fall,
okay,
is publishing that one.
Do you find that your working titles at the end of the book, when you finally hit the last period and you're done with it, the titles stay the same, or do you think to yourself, oh no, this title is not going to work for this book?
No, I have found that I've had to change titles, and I'm thinking of that in terms of Confessions of a Canadian Girl in Training, because Canadians would understand the irony in that title. I mean, Tilly is anything but a Canadian girl in training. She, you know, doesn't follow the kind of standard mode. So I'm thinking American readers who look at that title are going to go, what? What's a Canadian girl in training?
Well, so I mean, I'm vicious, but I could. They're probably wrong.
I'm sorry. What did you mean by that?
Oh, because you know, a Canadian girl in training. I mean, what is she in training for?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah.
Well, I think it's going to stir a lot of interest, because I would look at that title and go, wait, I want to find out about Canadian girls.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And what are they in training for?
What are they in training for?
That's the curiosity part.
I'm happy that I raised that with you guys. I'll keep that in mind. But I know I have changed titles of books.
Me too.
Yeah.
I actually, my wife does my editing, and she, when I finish a book and I've got a working title, she'll come back and she'll go, no. No. My very last book is called Jefferson's Chance, and that was Jerry's title. And she came in and she goes, you know what? You got a guy here named Jefferson Greeley, and he's wanted to be a Texas Ranger his whole life, and they finally have given him a chance. So Jefferson's Chance became the title of the novel.
Uh-huh.
And it took off like a scalded cat.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with it.
That's great.
We are actually out of time, Lily.
Can you believe it?
I know. When you get a fun guest on, it just goes fast. Huh, Russ?
Indeed it does.
Indeed it does. Can you tell
you're
our...
You're just going to be on here to slow things down.
I know.
You're trying to slow things down.
Yeah. Tell our listeners where they can find you. Email, website, yes. Whatever.
Yes, I have a blog. And I post once a week something about reading or writing. So if they're interested, please visit me. It's lilyionamackenzie.com. And that's LILYIONAMACKENZIE.com. I love visitors.
Oh, good. Well, I'm sure you will have a few.
Maybe. I hope.
I think you probably will. And we really appreciate you spending this hour with us or 50 minutes with us. And,
well, lovely to meet the two of you.
Well, and it was lovely meeting you as well.
Same here, yes. Definitely, Lily.
And
I can't see all your dogs, Russ. They sound wonderful.
They're all wagging their tails saying, hi, Lily.
Yeah. when your book
I don't
out,
have a tail to wag, so I'll just wave.
There you go. When your book comes out in the fall, holler at the bookie and see if she can't get your book for another show.
Okay, dear. I'll do that.
Okay. And thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you for doing this show.
Oh, you're so welcome. And
bye-bye.
Lily Iona McKenzie. And her book was Free Fall, something comedy? Anyway.
A divine comedy.
Divine comedy. Interesting story for those of you who are really interested in four women getting together and the trouble they can get into in two continents. Go for it.
You know what I have to say, I really liked about her is that, first of all, she's very sweet.
She is.
But, and I was kind of surprised because her characters are kind of, not as sweet.
Right.
But the other thing was, is that she's very inquisitive about anything that we would say that maybe wasn't totally clear. She steps right, what do you mean by that?
I appreciate that
in a person so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, next week we have Savannah Hendrick. She's a revisitor. This is her second trip into the writer's block. Let's see what she's got to say for herself by then. That, of course, will be with Bobby G. Bell. Russ, I thank you so much. And, of course,
it's always a pleasure, Jimmy.
The third Thursday I always look forward to because it's just it's fun being on the air with you.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
And even if you don't mean it, it was nice to hear.
No, I do mean it. I do mean it. In fact, for Christmas, I'm going to send you a hairbrush.
Oh, okay. I need to do that. I'm not going to use this webcam anymore.
Oh, no, I think you should. You know, Jonathan Silverman, that's who you're looking like.
Oh, yeah. I know who he is.
The most interesting man in the world.
Actually, my picture on Facebook is with
him. Jonathan Silverman, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so if you really want to know what Jonathan Silverman looks like, go to Russ's picture on his Facebook.
Yeah,
okay. For Russ Avistead and myself, Bobby Jean Bell, Jim Bell, Ronan Rosner, and of course, the owner of LA Talk Radio, Sam Hassan, who makes all of this possible, we are out of here.